Chapter 26. Borrowed Time. The scare of that summer should have snapped Jenny and me out of our denial about Marley's advancing age, but we quickly returned to the comfortable assumption that the crisis was a one-time fluke and his eternal march into the sunset could resume once again. Despite all his frailties, he was still the same happy-go-lucky dog. His daily routine included barking at the mailman, visiting the chickens, staring at the bird feeder, and making the rounds of the bathtub faucets to check for any drips of water he could lap up. Several times a day he flipped the lid up on the kitchen trash can to see what goodies he could scavenge. On a daily basis, I continued to pry open his jaws and extract from the roof of his mouth all sorts of flotsam from our daily lives, potato skins and muffin wrappers, discarded Kleenex and dental floss. Even in old age, some things did not change. As September 11th, 2003 approached, I drove across the state to the tiny mining town of Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where United Flight 93 had crashed into an empty field on that infamous morning 2 years earlier amid a passenger uprising. The hijackers who had seized the flight were believed to be heading for Washington, D.C., to crash the plane into the White House or the Capitol, and the passengers who rushed the cockpit almost certainly saved countless lives on the ground. To mark the second anniversary of the attacks, my editors wanted me to visit the site and take my best shot at capturing that sacrifice and the lasting effect it had on the American psyche. I spent the entire day at the crash site, lingering at the impromptu memorial that had risen there. I talked to the steady stream of visitors who showed up to pay their respects, interviewed locals who remembered the force of the explosion, sat with a woman who had lost her daughter in a car accident and who came to the crash site to find solace in communal grief. I documented the many mementos and notes that filled the gravel parking lot. Still, I was not feeling the column. What could I say about this immense tragedy that had not been said already? I went to dinner in town and pored over my notes. After I finished my meatloaf and iced tea, I headed back to the hotel to try to write. Halfway there, on an impulse, I pulled a U-turn and drove back out to the crash site, several miles outside town, arriving just as the sun was slipping behind the hillside and the last few visitors were pulling away. I sat out there alone for a long time as sunset turned to dusk and dusk to night. A sharp wind blew down off the hills, and I pulled my windbreaker tight around me. Towering overhead, a giant American flag snapped in the breeze, its colors glowing almost iridescent in the last smoldering light. Only then did the emotion of this sacred place envelop me and the magnitude of what happened in the sky above this lonely field begin to sink in. I looked out on the spot where the plane hit the earth, and then up at the flag, and I felt tears stinging my eyes. For the first time in my life, I took the time to count the stripes. 7 red, 6 white. I counted the stars, 50 of them, on a field of blue. It meant more to us now, this American flag. To a new generation, it stood once again for valor and sacrifice. I knew what I needed to write. I shoved my hands into my pockets and walked out to the edge of the gravel lot, where I stared into the growing blackness. Standing out there in the dark, I felt many different things. One of them was pride in my fellow Americans, ordinary people who rose to the moment, knowing it was their last. One was humility, for I was alive and untouched by the horrors of that day, free to continue my happy life as a husband and father and writer. In the lonely blackness, I could almost taste the finiteness of life and thus its preciousness. I was reminded of what should be obvious but too often is not, that each day, each hour and minute, is worth cherishing. I felt something else as well, an amazement at the boundless capacity of the human heart. At once big enough to absorb a tragedy of this magnitude, yet still find room for the little moments of personal pain and heartache that are part of any life. And in my case, one of those little moments was my failing dog. With a tinge of shame, I realized that even amid the colossus of heartbreak that was Flight 93, I could still feel the sharp pang of the loss I knew was coming. Marley was living on borrowed time, that much was clear. Another health crisis could come any day, and when it did, I would not fight the inevitable. Any invasive medical procedure at this stage in his life would be cruel, something Jenny and I would be doing more for our sake than his. We loved that crazy old dog, loved him despite everything, or perhaps because of everything. But I could see now the time was near for us to let him go. I got back in the car and returned to my hotel room. The next morning, my column filed, I called home from the hotel. Jenny said, "I just want you to know that Marley really misses you. He's driving us all bonkers." The night before, unable to find me, Marley had paced and sniffed the entire house over and over, she said, poking through every room, looking behind doors and in closets. He struggled to get upstairs, and not finding me there, came back down and began his search all over again. He was really out of sorts, she said. He even braved the steep descent into the basement, where, until the slippery wooden stairs put it off limits to him, Marley had happily kept me company for long hours in my workshop, snoozing at my feet as I built things, the sawdust floating down and covering his fur like a soft snowfall. Once down there, he couldn't get back up the stairs, and he stood yipping and whining until Jenny and the kids came to his rescue, holding him beneath the shoulders and hips and boosting him up step by step. The next morning, Jenny went downstairs to make breakfast. A couple of hours passed before it dawned on her that Marley still had not shown his face, which was highly unusual. She found him sleeping soundly on the floor, tight against my side of the bed. Then she saw why. When she had gotten up, she had inadvertently pushed her pillows, she sleeps with three of them, over to my side of the bed beneath the covers, forming a large lump where I usually slept. With his Mr. Magoo eyesight, Marley could be forgiven for mistaking a pile of feathers for his master. "He absolutely thought you were in there," she said. "I could just tell he did. He was convinced you were sleeping in."